Hello, this is Curtis Edwards, Vice President of Investor Relations at Hudson Investing. Are you ready to start building your multifamily portfolio? Kent and I are excited to announce our newest deal in Spartanburg, South Carolina. This 157-unit property offers a unique chance to acquire a B-class value-add property for just $120,000 per door. This is well below replacement costs. De-risking the deal even further is a favorable loan assumption with over 6 years remaining at 3.73% fixed. With 50 economic development projects underway and 70,000 jobs within a 20-minute drive, the South Carolina Upstate region is primed for above-average job, population, and rent growth. Don't miss out on this exclusive deal. Find the link in the description notes to learn how you can invest.
But the other thing is that, and that's really important, is that when you start talking to investors and say, well, we're working on this thing, right? And are you interested in hearing about it? They don't want to have you come back a week later and say, oh, we didn't get it, right? Or, oh, we woke up to our underwriting and it didn't work out. People want confidence.
Welcome to Right Around Real Estate, the show about how to passively invest like a pro. On each episode, I interview real estate experts who give their top investing advice, strategies, and tools, and I break down their insights into practical steps to avoid the pitfalls and make better investments. I want to help you passively invest like a pro. This is Ritter on Real Estate, and I'm your host, Kent Ritter. Hello, fellow investors. Welcome to another episode of Ritter on Real Estate, where we teach you how to passively invest like a pro. Today, my guest is Mark Hamilton, and Mark is a veteran real estate investing expert, and he is the founder of Hamilton Zanz, which is a real estate investment firm with, get this, a portfolio of over $4.3 billion in assets under management, and it's all specializing in multifamily. So Mark is going to share just a wealth of knowledge with us today. Excited to dig into that a little more. His company is one of the nation's largest privately held multifamily syndication companies with over 20,000 units under management. And Mark has positioned himself in other ways as really an expert in the 1031 exchange. And imagine through his 20 plus year career, kind of all things real estate. So Mark, thank you so much for joining today and really happy to have you on the show.
Thank you, Kent. I'm really grateful to be here.
Yeah, so you know, I gave you a little bit of a high level overview, but I really think people like to hear from you and your own story. So can you share with folks, you know, a little more of who you are and how you got to where you are today?
Well, some of it was really kind of by misadventure. Back in the ancient times, when I was in college and eventually graduate school, I had a passion for, or maybe I should say an aspiration to be a writer or a lit teacher. Be in the academy somehow. And after I got my graduate degree, I realized that wasn't for me. And so I had logged a year in a commercial real estate firm before getting my master's degree, just to sock away some money for graduate school. And was kind of twiddling my thumbs after graduate school. My wife, the gal I would eventually marry, she and I had plans to go to Japan to teach English. We wanted to travel, and she got cold feet at the last bit, and it just wasn't realistic for me to think I would go without her. And so I went back to that same real estate firm, and just kind of, I don't want to say I treaded water, but I looked at different options while I was there. Again, I was biding my time, and my boss at the time, Laurie, and I had actually bought a broken down duplex in San Francisco. And we're flailing away at it. We had our day jobs, and we were sanding floors and painting and installing cabinets and putting down tile at night. And my boss asked if we could make money doing that. The firm was doing much bigger things. And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, what are you doing sitting at your desk then? Go out and find us some deals. And so he was our angel investor. And that led to a period of 16 years where I was really active in San Francisco and eventually Oakland, California, which is across the bay, just looking for stuff that could obviously use a little bit of love and heavy lifting, And, you know, buying them with friends and family and then selling them and moving on to the next thing. And I really kind of fell in love with it. I was, you know, it's like with multifamily, for a lot of people, if you're in it for 2 or 3 years, you'll be in it for the rest of your life, because it is, it has its own intrigue about it. But in 2001, I met Tony Zanz, my partner. He had a total institutional pedigree. He worked for big commercial real estate firms, has an MBA from Wisconsin. And we met, and he, mostly what he needed at the time was help, management help with a small portfolio that he had. But as we got to know each other, he was really ready for a change. And so one day he said, "I want to be your partner." And I said, the best thing that could happen to you is I'd say no. Why would you want to do this? Why would you want to give up the job that you had? Because it was very, you know, it was with a very distinguished company. And he said, "It just, I'm ready for a change. I'm tired of the corporate life. I'm tired of making everybody else's money for them." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm easy. Yeah, let's do it. If it doesn't work out, I'm just going to go back to doing what I'm doing. I think you're taking the risk." But it really worked out. He brought a lot of institutional rigor, institutional best practices. A lot of it had to do with underwriting. Together, we were both fairly adept as asset managers. I had some proficiency in project management by then and risk management. And we made a good little team, and it was the two of us and one other person. And this was 2001. And, you know, we were sitting in our little office looking at each other when 9/11 happened. And you know, selfishly, we're thinking, what is this going to do? But, you know, we got through it. We got through a variety of challenges. Our first acquisition was a 16-unit building in Oakland. And we just went on doing one thing at a time, taking a deal at a time, making sure we understood the opportunity, being in touch with people who, friends and family, who were our investors. And, you know, fast forward 20 years, last year we closed just over $1 billion of acquisitions. And so I would say, you know, you take it one day at a time, you stay in touch with people, you really treasure and pamper as much as you can the great people that you have in your organizations. And spread the love, you know, spread the love economically, and just stay with the work. And people really appreciated it. We've never advertised. We've never raised money through broker dealers. It's always been our own outreach to our own investors. And right now that number is about 1,300 investors. We've also done about 40 deals with institutions and institutional JVs. But you know, you're going to have some ups and downs along the way. The Great Recession was a nail biter. We downsized our firm, but got through. And during the coronavirus, during the pandemic, we haven't laid anybody off. We made a commitment. We had kind of built a nest egg, a rainy day fund, and sat on it. And we just made a commitment that to ourselves and to our staff that we weren't going to lay anybody off and we were going to hunker down. And 2020 ended up being a pretty busy year for us. We got rewarded by keeping the team whole. It was our third busiest year. And then last year was our busiest year. So, I mean, again, I think the biggest part of it really is just getting great people and hanging on to them.
Yeah. Well, Mark, that's a fantastic story. There's a lot to unpack there. And so I want to start to kind of break this down a little bit. So you started, really, you started more, you said, kind of really small scale, right? It was a duplex at first, and it was more of a flip.
Yeah, except we lived in it. We bought it as a home. It was in a part of town that was improving. We figured it was that if we were willing to put in the tough love and sacrifice, it would be worth more than we paid for it. And that turned out to be true. Yeah. The market, I mean, we all know that over the last 40 years, interest rates have gone from 20 to 2, almost in a straight line. So I don't want to say that you didn't have to know what you were doing, but that helped all of us. And, you know, urbanification, I don't want to say gentrification, but re-urbanizing helped a lot of us who were working in inside the cities. And, and you know, then tech happened, right? So there was a lot of job growth and a lot of wage growth. And it was a good time to be in San Francisco. And sure. Laurie and I owned that property for not quite 3 years and sold it and went into another project that we also lived in. And at that time we had some good friends of hers from her hometown where it had come to San Francisco, and they were doing the same thing. And so on New Year's Eve, 1986, Andy Serkin says, I want to make a toast. We should all quit our jobs and go into business together. And again, it was the same thing. It was like, okay, you know, I mean, I don't see the downside. Let's do it. Yeah. But again, you know, it comes back to people. It comes back to having, you know, measuring your opportunities as best as you can and really being a pessimist when you're underwriting, because if you, you know, if it's too rosy, you might get disappointed or hurt.
Yeah. So you started off small. Fast forward 2001, you meet your partner. It sounds like from there, things really take off.
Yep.
And so how, I mean, talk to me a little bit about growing that firm. I mean, how many people do you guys have today?
60.
60.
And we, so have 60, we have 60 at Hamilton Zanz. We have a smaller affiliated company that does the same thing that we do, but with commercial, office, and light industrial. And they have, I think, 5 people. Mm-hmm. We have a commercial property management company that has 2 or 3 dozen people. And then the biggest part of the business is the residential management company, which is managed out of Denver. It's called Mission Rock Residential, and they have about 800 employees. But at Hamilton Zanz, it's about 60.
Gotcha. But altogether, I mean, you've got, you know, close to 1,000 employees, it sounds like.
Yep.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about, I mean, can you kind of describe scaling that business from 2001 to 2021? I mean, what were the, I guess, how did you just strategically think about growth? How did you think about, you know, when do I add this person? When does it make sense to bring somebody on? And how do you measure that cost versus the benefit as you grow?
Those are really great questions. I wish that more people would ask about that. And so it's interesting because by 2001, you know, I was almost mid-career at that point. And my partner, Tony, was too. And I mean, what I was most concerned about was he had a really good job. And so it's like, what are we going to do to make sure that there's incoming revenue? Because it was all transactionally based. Mm-hmm. We did, you know, I started charging asset management fees in the early 90s. Whereas I hadn't in the 80s, but that was maybe almost enough to pay for the office, right? To keep the lights on. So you really have to have confidence that you're going to have deal flow. Again, we benefited from the 40-year bond rally. We were buying it at high cap rates and low gross rent multipliers, and things just kept compressing. Local income, demographic, you know, income based on demographics and the like continued to rise in the Bay Area. And as it did, returns went down. You know, people were hungry for the asset class. They wanted to buy multifamily. They saw that rents just kept going up. And so more and more buyers came in. And so it got competitive. I had moved my focus from San Francisco, where I didn't think I could find any transaction volume anymore. Over to Oakland and kind of kickstarted it again. And that worked. Oakland was improving. And that's where my partner, Tony, hit his first 2 deals. So, you know, I think that the first 2 things that we did right, well, I mean, it was a good match because I was a little more hands-on and he was a little more educated in finance. You know, the first 2 things we did that were right, or that we understood that were right, is that we really had to focus on a pipeline of income. And that came from good transaction flow. It came from being in touch with our investors, which were friends and family. And they, you know, they numbered a few dozen at that point. And make sure that we understood who was maybe game for an investment, and that we are spending a lot of time working with brokers and anyone who could bring us a transaction. And so we went through not quite 4 years of having good transaction flow. from the time we became partners. But then once again, returns compressed. And, you know, we were buying, I don't want to use the term flip, but we were buying to renovate, hold as needed, add value, and then move on. And so we've always, you know, for a very long time, we've used the 1031 exchange. And but you know, you harvest profit with a 1031, you have to reinvest it. So you have to go somewhere. And we just weren't seeing the arc or the curve for returns in the Bay Area. So we started looking elsewhere. And that was, you know, so making sure that we were in touch with people to create a pipeline and understanding the necessity of finding returns instead of just standing pat. I would learn a long time later that Tony thought that we would just build up a kind of a Bay Area portfolio and have a Bay Area portfolio and sit on it. And that would be that. I'm glad he didn't tell me that. Because it's like, really, we're just going to twiddle our thumbs. But our first market outside the Bay Area was Spokane, Washington, of all places, because somebody I knew brought us a deal. I tried to shake it down and pick it apart, and it wouldn't go. It held together. He was able to answer all the questions from somebody being pessimistic. And then so I moved him over to Tony, and Tony also thought it made sense, and he hopped on an airplane and was up there. And I'd never done that. You know, I had always assumed that I could do my job anywhere I, you know, could get with my car, you know, anywhere within 90 minutes. But Tony had flown all over God's acre, and it didn't cause him to pause at all about going out of state. And so from having one property in Spokane, then we just pounded that market, you know, got in front of people, out hustled, outworked others. And we ended up doing 7 deals in Spokane. From there, we went west and went out to the Puget Sound. And in the Puget Sound, we've probably done, you know, we've probably acquired 20 to 30 properties over the years. And then we just looked for markets. After that, it was Las Vegas and Colorado Springs and Phoenix. And we're probably, you know, we have a list of markets that are on in our scoring system. And we probably own in maybe half of the markets that we think are worth a close look. Mm-hmm. And so then it just becomes a matter of finding returns, which is our job. And we probably take in 3,000 to 4,000 submissions a year. It's a lot, you know, and a lot of them don't even get a close look. But if somebody we know or a broker that we've worked with who knows us really pushes us and tells us a story and it sounds good, then we'll underwrite it. And in a normal year, we'll underwrite 2 to 250 opportunities. We'll probably send out offers or letters of intent on maybe 50. And then from there, if we get 10 to 15, you know, maybe even 20, if we get somewhere between 10 and 20, it's a good year. Mm-hmm. We had that kind of year last year, but we also were able to buy a portfolio of properties out of bankruptcy. And that just on the apartment side, that piece was about $350 million. And we did $700 million of acquisitions otherwise, and then also had acquisition activity that in our commercial platform.
Gotcha. So I want to point out something that you just alluded to, or you gave some numbers about, because I think a lot of people that look at what we do buying apartments from the exterior don't really understand that it is a volume game. I mean, you mentioned that you get 3,000 to 4,000 submissions a year, meaning deals that are coming into your inbox, right? Or one way or the other. And you're going through and you have a very systematic process to vet those out to where you're only underwriting a handful of those, maybe less than 10%, it sounded like. And then
we probably underwrite less than 10%.
Yeah. And then but you've got to have that high volume at the top of the funnel to get down to a handful of 10 deals a year at the end. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, you know, when people focus so much on, they get caught up on the underwriting as they're getting started and focused on, you know, just getting that LOI out, and getting that LOI out is kind of a big accomplishment. And then you talk to somebody like yourself, you say, no, you gotta be sending, you know, LOIs every week. You got to be looking at a lot of deals. You got to be moving to really find those diamonds in the rough.
Absolutely.
And if you're doing more than that, then you're probably not being as critical as you need to on those individual deals, right?
Agree completely. You have to be willing to be your own biggest enemy when you're underwriting. You know, you can't, certainly you need to be optimistic. You need to look for, you need to look for opportunity. You need to look for upside because the market is so saturated with capital right now that no one's giving anything away. And so you have to really be persnickety about your underwriting, not only because that's the only real way you're going to find opportunity, but the other thing is that, and that's really important, is that when you start talking to investors and say, well, we're working on this thing, right? And are you interested in hearing about it? They don't want to have you come back a week later and say, oh, we didn't get it, right? Or, oh, we woke up to our underwriting and it didn't work out. People want confidence. So we generally don't talk much to investors until we're really sure that something is going to stick, not only that we've underwritten it and gotten a contract, but have really started the due diligence process and really believe that we're going to be able to hang on. So you have to have that. But the other thing too is sellers want the same thing. They want confidence. They want performance. They want to close, period. And so, you know, if you have the bandwidth, you can't really do it without bandwidth, but you use your bandwidth to really qualify your opportunities and then you go at them hard. You're putting up non-refundable money when necessary, you know, swallowing stuff that might not be that appetizing in terms of projects or one thing or another, or any other aspect that needs an overhaul or an update, just dealing with it. But that's what people want. People want confidence. And so if you start out really looking for the trap doors, as well as the upside, you'll serve yourself better. And then when you're ready, you got to lock and load, and you got to do that more than once. You know, like we talked about earlier, we're going to underwrite 2 to 250 deals a year. We're probably going to write 50 offers. So, and that's to get 10, right? And so you don't want people to become cynical about you, right? You got to be able to defend your underwriting, but people know us as closers. We've closed about 225 acquisitions in the last 20 years. And we've only had a very small handful of deals that didn't work out. And on a few occasions, it was because the operation was really just a mess and was declining, and our ability to get debt declined as the performance of the opportunity declined. Mm-hmm. A couple of times we got stuck in financing meltdowns and financing basically evaporated. And that's basically it. You know, once in a while, we'll maybe have a seller who becomes difficult, but I think we've closed more than 95% of anything we've ever put in contract. And that's what people want. They want to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, that is the number one thing, right? Is even more than the price that you're willing to offer is the assurance that you're going to close and that you're not going to waste people's time.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've done a lot of repeat business with institutions. There are a number of big institutions, and we've probably purchased a third of everything we've ever bought through institutions that we've done repeat business with.
Gotcha. Yeah. You have the track record, and you do what you say you're going to do, and
that's it.
And people want to come back to you.
Yeah. And people know that we're not necessarily going to pay the last dollar, but we're going to close. Right. And we'll be right there. You know, it'll be a photo finish. If somebody beats us on price, well, you know, it happens once in a while. But if we win, if we get picked, we're going to close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think one thing that can be difficult for folks that are looking to invest is deciding which market to invest in. I mean, there's markets all over the country, right? Which one should we be in? Where should we be putting our money? So from a sophisticated group like yourself, how do you look at markets? And you mentioned some scoring. I mean, you don't have to give away the secret sauce, but what are some of the criteria that you look at and judge to say, this is a market that we want to be in?
Well, I would say, you know, a few very user-friendly benchmarks are going to be rising income, rising employment. Yeah. And you can quantify all this through different statistical sources, but we want inbound employment gains of good jobs, right? Of high wage jobs. And so you're going to look at median incomes, household incomes in the immediate areas that you think you might buy. You're also going to look for, curiously, relatively high single family home prices. That's going to be an indicator that the wages are there. And if they're high enough that you don't graduate from college and just go buy your first house, right? That you're going to have to save for a while. If they're high enough, that creates a real incentive for people to rent. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of lifestyle renting going on right now that people just, in many cases, just don't want the burden of homeownership anymore. But, you know, generally speaking, you're going to look for a metro area of at least 250,000 people. If it has a major university or a major medical center, or it's a state capital, or it could be maybe a military installation. You know, you want a mix of foundation pieces that are going to support the economy. Mm-hmm. And then you also want it to be diversified. But we're investing quite a bit in Tennessee right now. And we like, we like Chattanooga and Clarksville just as much as we like Nashville. We started getting into Nashville 10 years ago. But when there's a lot of big ticket economic development going on in a metro area, that's something you're going to want to pay attention to. Of course, that happens in big cities too, whether it's New York or Seattle or San Francisco. But returns in those markets are highly compressed, and you're just going to have to grind to find something that's got better than ordinary returns. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned a number of things, but boils down to job diversity and growth, right? You don't want all your eggs in one basket. You don't want a town. Typically where, you know, everybody works at one factory and that factory could go out of business.
That's right.
You want job diversity, you want job growth. I mean, it's been my experience that rents follow job growth.
No question.
And then you mentioned healthcare, you mentioned education, you mentioned government. Those are non-cyclical types of jobs, right? Okay. That are going to be steady during the ups and downs. So those are all great indicators, all great lessons for folks that are listening, things to look for in the deals that you're evaluating and the markets that you want to be in.
Well, Kent, moreover, I would say I agree with everything you said, but I would also say if you're really just looking for some signposts, heavy infrastructure work in a city is also a clue that the future is coming, that it's been seen and it's coming. We saw a lot of that in Denver. You'll see it from time to time, place to place with major airport expansions. Austin had airport expansion work going on for a number of years before it got on the headlines. That's another thing to look for.
Yeah, really, really good tip and something that people can easily find in the news. Yeah, very good. So, Mark, as we shift gears a little bit here, I'm fascinated by the size of the organization you guys have been able to grow and having 20,000 units, and probably that's under management now. So even more of that from an experience standpoint.
With our activity from last year, we have about 24,000 units in our portfolio. And then Mission Rock, which also manages for a number of big institutions, mm-hmm. has got about another 6,000 on top of our portfolio.
Gotcha. So a lot to learn from. So share with our listeners, what are some of your biggest lessons learned over the career, as you're really from an investment standpoint, where maybe there's some examples of things that you thought were going to go well and didn't, or the other way around. And, can you share a couple lessons with us?
Of course. So in the early years, in the very early years, in the 80s and 90s, we were just buying properties with probably short-term bank debt a lot, 3 to 5 years, maybe a bridge loan. We also borrowed from savings and loans. And those would have been fully amortizing loans, but variable. And by the time we got to uh, by the time Tony and I became partners, it wasn't long after that we realized we really wanted long-term fixed rate debt. And so generally, from time to time, we'll get debt that's longer. We've borrowed a fair amount of 12-year debt in our portfolio. We have some 15. I think we have a 20-year. We might even have an FHA loan that goes out 30 years. But probably 90% of the acquisitions we've done have been 10-year debt or thereabouts. The one time that we took out short-term fixed rate debt, which was 5 years long, we got hurt. And that was because the Great Recession came along. Nobody was loaning. We were partners then with a major bank on an acquisition. And they said, you know, we love you guys. You're doing a great job. We don't want to be in this deal anymore. We're not gonna put up the capital to deleverage it. So here you can, we'll give you these two properties for a dollar each. What do you say? And all we were going to have to do is come up with $22 million that we didn't have to deleverage the loan. Yeah. And so, you know, that was the only time we took out short-term fixed rate debt. And we did so at the wrong time. We've always been really, really good at driving net operating income. And we did that in that particular case, but we didn't drive a net operating income up enough to cover a 20% shortfall in our debt stack. So, you know, long-term fixed rate debt, we're believers, especially now, you know, with rates where they are now. I don't know how they go down from here, but we're believers in long-term fixed rate debt, even though we got hurt that one time. You know, if rates, wherever you lock in, if rates drop in response to economic weakness, you could have a period of some tightness. You know, you might even have to idle, you know, to lower or idle your distribution. But if you have enough term, you're probably going to ride it out. Mm-hmm. So we've always been believers in fixed rate debt. And the other thing you just have to, you have to know that you're seeing the opportunity correctly, that you've looked at the market activity, you've looked at the sales comps, you looked at the rent comps, you've really gotten in deep on the operation and really understand what capital needs a property is going to have, but also if it's going to operate as you think it will. Because at the end of the day, you got money at stake and you've got your, you know, you've borrowed, you got your, you know, you've got credit, you've got debt, and you just, having it go backwards is really not an option. So you have to really be satisfied that you're looking at the upside correctly. And there are no markers for that other than what has taken place. Sales comps, those are, even if it was yesterday, that's something that's in the rearview mirror. You have to really look at what's taken place and understand and draw conclusions about demand based on what's taken place and whether or not you're getting a good value when you buy it. And you have to do the same thing with rents. You have to really be dispassionate in your assessments of rental income. And if you think you're going to dazzle everybody, you may be overspending. You know, prospective tenants, they vote with their feet. They're going to, we all do, you know, we're going to look at everything that's kind of within the bracket of what we want to look at. And then we're going to choose. No one's really going to, in this business, no one's really going to move into the first apartment they see. So you know, go ahead.
I'm curious because what I've seen a lot, you know, over the past year, we've seen some incredible just asset appreciation. We've seen prices kind of hit records all over the place. In response to that, I've seen a lot of operators moving toward higher leverage, you know, which is typically bridge, shorter term, could be variable. So it's kind of the opposite of what you're saying, which is definitely the safer approach. I'm just curious your take kind of with everything that's been happening over the last year. And I think a lot of people expect to continue into 2022. I mean, I guess, how do you think about all that? How do you think about the asset appreciation and how do you approach deals and how do you think about debt? Can the long-term fixed debt still allow you to be competitive in this environment?
Good questions. And you're right. There are a lot of people in this industry favor short-term debt. They favor bridge debt or modified construction loans or one thing or another. It might be 3 years. It might be 3 years with a couple of 1-year options. It might be 5 years. We're definitely contrarians that way a little bit. You know, we've always assumed that interest rates have would move against us, and they haven't. That protecting the investor capital, you know, of friends and family, we just really didn't want to be in a position where interest rates moved against us and we were variable. And then you get into a question of, are you going to be able to cover your expenses and service your debt? So we've always favored security that way. And it comes with a cost, because if you're taking out fixed rate debt, you're going to have some kind of a prepayment structure. And so if you hit the window to sell the property and it's just perfect, and you have a variable loan, you're going to make more money than you would if you have a fixed rate loan. But we tend to buy in the early years. I think by 2006 or 2007, we could see that the average hold for us was around 3.5 years, was around 42 months. And back then we were borrowing fixed, but we were using a fair amount of bank debt. So the prepayment penalties weren't really that hard. But as returns went down, and as we had to work harder and harder to find distributable income, we felt there was a premium on going ever longer. And right now our average hold is probably 6 to 7 years. But if you took out the first 10 years, or maybe I should say, if you look at the last 15 years instead of the last 20, you'd see that our holds are even longer. With bank debt, you're probably not going to get any relief from a prepayment penalty, but it will very likely be a bland structure of fixed percentages. With conduit debt, with CMBS debt, prepayment penalty is a fact of life. You're going to have it, period. With agency debt, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, same thing, but you can also resize the debt. If performance is up enough, you can add supplemental financing behind that. And these loans are all assumable. So, you know, if you're going to be short, if you know you're going to be short, long-term fixed rate debt is not for you. But I also think that being short right now is really hard. I'm sure there are plenty of people who do it very well. It's really, you know, I think of us as a spot market investor because we're invested in 17 states and in 28 markets, but we'll only do business in any given year in a large handful. You know, we'll probably be active in 6 to 8 markets this year. Last year, same thing. So we pick our spots, and you know, if you're a small local operator, You're probably going to know your market better, or you could know your market better, your market opportunity better than some of the big guys if you're right there, and especially if you're in a related industry, whether, you know, maybe property management. You're going to see things that might fly under the radar for the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes a ton of sense. And just kind of following that question, I mean, what's the prediction for 2022? Is it continued? Do you think we continue to see asset appreciation to the rest of this year? And then what does that mean? Just going back to the debt question, what does that mean from a leverage standpoint for folks?
So those are good questions. I would say they're really, I'll look at two different parts or two different answer pathways. For you, I do think that on the operating side, our operations are going to continue to strengthen. About a year ago, we saw some data, and it was widely publicized. I'm sure you probably heard about it. That in terms of 18 to 34 year olds nationwide, there was an all time high number of those people living with their folks, or with a family member, or you know, doubled up in some way. A strategy that's definitely crafted to relieve or reduce the need to pay rent, right? People in a holding pattern. I think that'll uncoil, and I think it'll turn into household formation. And as jobs continue to grow, which they have, that pent up demand will uncoil and come into the market. I think that's a big part of what's driving purchases and investment assumptions right now. when in the Great Recession, we saw the same thing, doubling up, spiked. People were deathly afraid of moving. They didn't want to move. If you didn't give them an excuse to move, they weren't going to move. Nobody wanted to have more crisis on their hands. And so what we found at that time was that if we just met the market and kept people in their homes, we were going to be okay. And we did have to reduce some distributions here and there in our portfolio, but we, except for the one that went backwards, we were able to hang on to things and come out of it. And I personally think that household formation, at the arc of household formation for the next, I'm going to say 3 to 5 years, I think will actually be steeper than it was coming out of the Great Recession. And I also think that that's a big part of what's driving the compression of cap rates. I think that wages will grow. I think wage growth is a good thing. People are being selective right now about choosing their jobs, and wages are going up. I think wages are going up across the country, probably in almost every job category. And we'll see some inflation, right? So I think on the operating side, there are good years ahead. We'll all know, in a few years, we'll all know how long the party lasts. But I believe we'll see that. I think we're seeing it already. On the other hand, I also think a lot of from the capital side, I think a lot of investors right now are calling this the top of the market. We're seeing more property on the market. I live in San Francisco. I drive around. I see a lot more for sale signs on small apartment buildings. We're seeing that with the bigger stuff nationwide, and mostly we're going to be a buyer of, anywhere between 200 and 600 apartments in one go, garden style. But with that kind of stuff, we're seeing more property on the market too. In 2020, people hunkered down. We didn't know whether or not to expect a pandemic discount on pricing or a pandemic spike. And we've definitely seen a pandemic premium, right? Rates went down, people hunkered down. A lot of other types of real estate, whether it's big shopping centers, hotels, some office buildings have kind of fallen out of favor or at least are held in less favor right now by institutional investors who still have to make real estate allocations. So, and then there's been a lot of foreign capital. So there's been an ocean of capital, rates of return are down. I believe prospects for long-term occupancy and growth, growth in occupancy and growth in income, in multifamily are strong, and we think we're seeing more opportunity. And so to me, that means that more investors are calling the top. Whether they'll exchange and go into another apartment building is anybody's guess. I'm sure some people will sell and cash out. Some people will sell apartments and go into net lease commercial. But I do think a fair number, some a more, I think there's a more robust cohort of people who are calling the top right now.
Gotcha. Now that's fantastic perspective. So it sounds like you believe that there's from an operational standpoint, the next, as you said, 3 to 5 years, we don't have a crystal ball, but there's going to be continued improvement. We think demand is going to continue to increase or at least stay high.
Yes.
Probably outpacing the supply, which ultimately causes those prices to rise. And so it sounds like multifamily next few years, solid asset class for investment, but there are some things to watch out for. And I think one thing I took away from what you said is you've got to be in good markets. First of all, they've got to be growing markets, we talked about job growth. We talked about wage growth, things that are job diversity, things that are important to look out for folks. Right. Mm-hmm. And if folks, if you pick the right markets and you pick the right operators for your investment, it sounds like there's some good tailwinds for multifamily in the years to come. So
that's what we think. And the 40-year bond rally and the drop in interest rates from 20 to 2, people have referred to that as the new normal for a long time. We'll just have to see. We'll have to see how low rates stay. I do think they'll go up, but I don't, I can't remember the last time we had to pay a 5% interest rate to borrow. We've been for quite a long time. We've been borrowing between I'd say maybe even 10 years. We've been borrowing 425 or less. And over the last 2 years, we've probably been borrowing 325 or less. We took down a fair amount of debt, 2.75.
Yeah. And it's a unique environment where money is more plentiful than it ever has been. And largely, like you said, at least over the last, 40 years or so, cheaper than it has been. So, it's a unique time in the market for sure. And we'll be excited to see what comes over 2020. As we wrap things up, Mark, you guys have a lot going on. If you could call one thing out, what are you most excited about in 2022?
I think recovery from the pandemic, life returning to normal. I think it'll be good for the soul of the nation. It'll be good for people, be good for all of us. I think it will help the economy. I think it will help household formation. But that's another thing that I think will give us an uptick this year. I hope it's this year. The pandemic may be with us for a while. It could be something that we get annually vaccinated for some period of time. But I would say the slow progression to norms, to returning to normalcy, is something that I'm really hopeful about and feeling optimistic about. And more personally, I really like what we're doing at the shop. We've got a terrific group of people who and the top performers that tend to come and stay. And they have they get various bites at the apple in terms of equity and participation. So it certainly makes sense for them, but it's also essential for us because if you're going to take investment capital from somebody, you have to be able to say with full conviction, yeah, we're going to be here. We're going to be here. This is going to be working for a long time. And we just completed our first 20 years. I think we're building for the next 20 in terms of things we're doing in the shop to create a really profitable long arc for people, a good experience for the investors, and a great experience for staff, because the old guard will retire at some point. We've got to have things taken care of, and we definitely have the team for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. It sounds like you guys have set a fantastic foundation and are ready for a lot of good things to come, Mark. Before I let you get out of here, I want to take you through our keys to success round. There's four questions I want to ask you. The first one is, and you've had a lot of experience with different investors doing a lot of deals. So if you put your investor hat on and you're looking to invest with somebody else, and you could only ask them one question, what would that one question be?
Kent, I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second. You were just launching into the...
Oh, you did? Book. Okay. Well, we'll cut that out and do it again. So put your investor hat on. If you were going to invest your money with someone else and there's only one question that you could ask, what would that one question be?
It's interesting. I'll give you more than one answer. I'm going to cheat. You have to know if the sponsor has their own skin in the game. Since 1992, I've made sure that I made an investment in every single thing that we did. Even when my wife and I were living on, and our kids were living on peanut butter and crackers, we figured out ways to put skin in the game. And it's just because, we have to tell the investors that we believe in it and that we're doing the same thing. So you want to have somebody that's got skin in the game. You want to have somebody that's got a track record. You want to have somebody that really and truly is going to be able to pay their own overhead, pay their bills. While they are, if they're starting, right? If they're beginners. But I think most importantly, those are all things that I love, but most importantly, you got to have good accounting. You got to have good reporting. That's a quality control measure. And if you can't account for the money and how it's going, it's just a big question mark. And that was actually something that happened to somebody else that led to an improvement in my career. Because Tony Zanz and his father were partners with a guy who was really good at finding deals. And, he knew how to look at a deal and see the upside in it, but he was terrible in the management functions and the accounting. And these guys were both bankers. My partner and his father were both veterans of real estate finance, and it just drove them nuts. And finally, they threw up their hands and said, we got to find help. And then they came to me. Mm-hmm. So, it was and I'm not much of an accountant either, but my wife ran her own management company for 25 years and the accounting was all there. So if I, you know, if I needed to go find out about it, you know, I just walked through a doorway and sat at my wife's desk and we went over stuff. And I think that really charmed my partner. He could see that we would, you know, that we'd roll up our sleeves and get into things, grip the dirty stuff. I was really good at doing that, but there were, you know, there were some controls in place and that, you know, he saw daylight there, but you know, you really have to have good accounting. If you're not going to be able to get good accounting, then you shouldn't invest your own money, let alone somebody else's.
Well, I think that's great perspective. Being a syndicator myself and knowing how difficult that those things can be on the back end and how important it is to be able to track that. That's not one that we've had somebody say before either. So I appreciate that as a new answer. And
yeah, it's not part of the business.
No, it's not sexy, right? But it's important. And like you said, if you don't know what's coming in and out, it's difficult to have your arms around all of it. So yeah, I completely agree. Accounting is crucial. Next question is, what are you most proud of in your career?
I have to say, I'm really blessed and honored to run with the people that I get to run with, and to have been able to run with a lot of great people. Every step of my career was facilitated or enhanced by somebody I was running with at the time. You know, my wife and I started out, you know, as a young married couple, doing dirty real estate stuff and became partners with another couple who wanted to do the same thing. And we grew slowly. But there are a lot of people who've made a big difference in my career. Certainly Tony Zanz. If you like the work and trust the work and you're grateful for the people you get, you get a pretty good shot. But I would just really say, I'm honored to run with the people that I get to run with in my world.
That's awesome. What's a book that everybody should read?
So I'm not going to give you a real estate or finance book. I'm not going to give you fiction either. But I would say probably anything by Michael Lewis or anything by Malcolm Gladwell. They're both journalists. They're thoughtful people. Sometimes they back onto the world of finance. But you know, you have to look for the unanticipated. And Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell is a really good book. It talks about things from a little bit more of a macro level, whereas I think of tipping points in my life as being small things, you know, small occurrences, meeting specific people, one thing or another. Mm-hmm. But you have to look for the unanticipated and believe in the unanticipated. You know, for me, that's where the rewards have been, picking up things that others missed, bumping into somebody, and forming a good, really good long-term relationship. But I think you have to look for the unanticipated. And I would say, again, anything by Malcolm Gladwell or Michael Lewis. And if you had to pick one, I would read Tipping Point.
Great recommendations. And lastly, what is your number one key to success?
Going to work every day. You know, I know that sounds all Norman Rockwell and the like. A very long time ago. A fellow that I didn't have really a very good relationship with, didn't have much of an affinity with him. You know, we'd kind of clashed in the past. He was an older fellow. For no good reason, took me under his wing. And I think it was just over a phone call. We were having a hard time. It was the early 90s. We didn't know how we were going to make ends meet. And he asked me what was going on. I said, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. And he said, I'll tell you exactly how you're going to get through this. You're going to go to work each day. You're going to put your head down. You're going to do the work you can do, right? You're not going to preoccupy yourself about things that are impossible. You're going to do that work every day. At the end of the day, you're going to put your phone down. This is when we still had phones on our desks. You're going to turn your computer off. You're going to go home and you're going to forget about it. You're just going to let it go. The next day, you're going to do the same thing. And it was transformative. It was transformative advice. I took it to heart and I didn't really have any choice in the matter. So I just doubled down every day and went to work and did the things that I could do, right? The outreach that I could do, the property evaluation that I could do, one thing or another. And lo and behold, it worked out. You know, the nose of the ship came up and off I went. And you know, but again, it comes back to the unexpected. The world is so rich. And if you have an opportunity to bump into good people and have good conversations and do your best to listen when you can and listen for the opportunity, you'll find things that you might not find if you're focusing way too hard.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic advice. And it just continues to be a theme when I ask that question of whether you say it as you show up to work or it's perseverance, it's just a common theme of people that have been successful. And so I think you share that. And the other thing that you alluded to is your network, right? You mentioned it's the great people around you that have continued to propel you forward. And you know, I constantly just want to tell people it is all about your network. You're going to be as successful as your network and as you nurture that network and
exactly
find those people and build those relationships with folks. And the other thing that you mentioned was just keeping your ears open for opportunities. And I think that's something that I think if you're receptive and open to it, I think, you know, opportunities will come to you and they will present themselves. You just have to be willing to, you know, to be able to say yes to them.
Well, I mean, I'm way wide of where I thought I was going to be 45 years ago. You know, I thought I was going to be this writer and I went to a good graduate school and I thought I'd be a college professor and all that. And that lit thing didn't work out so well, but it seems like this real estate thing might still. So
you might do okay.
It might still work out. And, you know, I'm just, it's a different life than I expected, but it's been a good life. And I've had a really great partner in my wife. You know, she had the same ethic. She ended up with the management business and just did the same thing, just went to work every day. Sometimes it's thankless work and you just do the work. And lo and behold, you know, things may start, things may gestate.
Yeah. And, you know, what I love about it is you've been doing this for 20 plus years and you can tell that you still have a passion for it. And I think that, like you said, when real estate gets you, when the bug gets you, it's true. You fall in love with it. And yep. You know, that's where I hope in 20 years that I'm in your position and I've still got that passion for it. And I think that's exactly where I see myself going. So Mark,
when I grow up and become, you know, a little bit more media savvy, my way up on my bucket list is an opportunity to interview you and see how you're doing. So, but I'm not your equal yet.
I love it. I appreciate that. Well, Mark, I've had a lot of fun talking with you. I appreciate your advice and thank you for bringing so much value to folks. If folks do want to learn more about you or more about Hamilton Zans, you know, how can they get a hold of you?
My email address is Mark, M-A-R-K at Hamilton, H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N, Zans, Z as in zebra, A, N as in Nancy, Z as in zebra, E as in Edward.com. Just shoot me an email and mention your show so that I remember.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate that. And we'll make sure that's all in the show notes. So folks, you can just scroll down and click right on that and get a hold of Mark. So Mark Hamilton, once again, thank you so much for being on the show. And with that, we will call it a day.
Thank you, Kent. I really appreciate it. You're a generous host.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Ritter on Real Estate. Hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on the content that will make you a better investor. Also, visit KentRitter.com for articles, videos, and tools curated just for passive investors. Until next time, this is Kent Ritter with Ritter on Real Estate. Now go out and invest like a pro.